Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
We bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna too many things.
Too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with the legendary Pete Seeger and, of course, David Burns, who wrote the words of that song. Except for Solartopia, the word I wrote, and this is the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Hour. We are here for another great hour, and this is a really big one at PRN, Gary Knowles, magnificent network. Thank you, Gary, for all the work you do, and Jesse and the crew in New York for putting this together. I know you're in new digs there, and it's been a major project in new studios, but I'm glad you're finally settled and stable. A very amazing guest today with me. We're going to just talk about immigration. John Carlos Frye, a five-time Emmy Award winner, freelance investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker based in L.A., been on programs like 60 Minutes, PBS, NBC News, CBS News, The Weather Channel. I'd like to get on The Weather Channel one of these days, actually. Dan Rather, Fusion TV, Current TV, Univision, Telemundo, but the important thing is also written for LA Times, Huffington, Salon, Need to Know Online, Washington Monthly, and El Diario. Born in Tijuana, so John, you're a Mexico native, but you are in LA, and your impressive resume just speaks for itself. You're going to be doing an event tomorrow night, Friday night, that is, in LA. I want you to talk about that. We're going to focus on immigration with you today. And, John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Yes, it was my pleasure to have you in the studio at KPFK last week in L.A. itself. And now we're on the podcast here at PRN, and we have a full hour. And one of the things you talked about in L.A. On KPFK was your experience coming across the border. You embedded yourself with a group, with a coyote, to do the border crossing, and we are going to talk about that in great detail. There's a couple of things I want to cover. First, the Supreme Court upheld partisan gerrymandering in North Carolina. It's a grotesque rape of our system. It's put that way. I'm from Ohio. Ohio is about 50-50 Democrat-Republican. But the congressional delegation is 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats. It's insane. It's obscene. It's absurd. The vote along party lines for the state house, the House and Senate in Columbus, was again split about 50-50. But the Republicans have of supermajorities in both houses of the Ohio legislature. It's absolutely obscene, ridiculous, totally anti-democratic. And I got to say, and I'm going to say this advisedly, that a big part of this problem with gerrymandering is because of the corporate Democrats. In the early part of this century, there was a movement in California to end gerrymandering. California was insanely gerrymandered. And it made sense. Arnold Schwarzenegger was a Republican governor, and he put in, I think, about $3 million of his own money, and they had a referendum in California to set up a nonpartisan, or well, somewhere between bipartisan and nonpartisan commission to redistrict the state along nonpartisan lines. And it passed first for the congressional delegation and then for the state house or vice versa. And we in California have a statewide commission. It's a citizens commission, bipartisan and nonpartisan, that establishes the districts in California. And by all accounts, it has effectively ended gerrymandering and done a really fair job of setting up the congressional and the state legislative districts in the state of California. Now, this was opposed by Nancy Pelosi of the corporate Democrats. If they'd have had half a brain in California when this anti-gerrymandering referendum was on the ballot, the corporate Democrats not only would have supported it, but they would have gone with it nationwide. And if we had these nonpartisan slash bipartisan commissions in all the states of the country, which we could have had in places like Ohio, which has a referendum and could have done this by referendum, then the congressional delegation would be split, you know, 8-8 or 9-7 instead of 12-4. And so this should not have been in front of the Supreme Court at all. This should have been done state by state with these commissions, citizens' commissions, to establish the congressional district. So as it is, we lost 5-4, and now, you know, and also, by the way, the corporate Democrats completely missed a state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin a few weeks ago. And in this race, a very good Democrat was running against a Republican. The National Democrats paid no attention whatsoever. The Democrat lost by a narrow margin, and therefore the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin is going to be upholding the gerrymandering in that state. So Nancy Pelosi, you know, no thanks. You should have been on the case here, and this gerrymandering could have been dealt with the way it was in California. And the lesson, of course, is the Democrats swept the California congressional races anyway, even in Orange County, where, you know, the Republicans have had the hold for decades, many, many decades. The Democrats won without gerrymandering. And so they can weep and moan all they want about the Supreme Court, but this gerrymandering situation should have been taken care of a long time ago along the lines of California. So we want to actually thank Arnold Schwarzenegger. Amazingly, the first thing I've ever thanked Arnold Schwarzenegger for. But he was instrumental in passing this referendum in California that set up the nonpartisan slash bipartisan commission that redistricted the state fairly, you know, along lines where you have actual competitive races. What a concept. So, and we're going to have to deal with that now. Obviously, we're not going to get rid of gerrymandering through the court system, and it's something we're going to have to go with. All right. So that's part one. Part two, and this is why we have John Carlos Frye with us, is the immigration situation. Now, the court today, did its usual expected number, and upheld. It actually surprised us, and it was John Roberts who surprised us. It defeated the citizenship question on the census, and this is a very big deal. John, do you want to talk about this? Is this in your bailiwick, the Supreme Court decision?
It's a little bit. I mean, immigrant rights advocates and the like were very concerned that people in the United States would not be counted, like minorities would not be counted, for fear of putting down personal information that might lead to their subsequent arrest if they were in the United States without papers. So the citizenship paper or citizenship requirement in the census was only going to count citizens and then not count non-citizens. So that would mean cities like Los Angeles, that has a very large population of non-citizens. We're not even talking about legal residents. We're talking about anybody who's not a citizen. And therefore, goods and services coming from the federal government wouldn't be appropriated properly because there's a large immigrant community in large meccas like Los Angeles and New York. So it sort of tipped the balance on purpose away from that population, and it didn't pass.
Right, and you make an important distinction here. It is possible to be a legal resident of the United States, but be a non-citizen, right?
If you are an immigrant from a foreign country, you go through a process. The very first process is to gain some sort of legal access to the United States, whether it's in the form of a visa or you have a family member who is a legal resident or citizen of the United States and you can be sponsored by them. But the first step for most people is what's known as a green card, which gives you legal residency. You can't vote, but you do have the legal right to be in the United States. You have legal access to everything else that, that we all do. You can drive a car, you can get a job, you can purchase a plane ticket, all of that sort of stuff. And then it becomes a process beyond that to become a U.S. citizen. And that requires some time. In some cases, it's 7 years, depending on where you're from and your background. And you have to take some courses. You have to understand U.S. history, and you have to learn how to speak English. And there are a couple of other requirements, and then you can apply for actual U.S. citizenship. So that is a lengthy process. So we're talking about the in-between people who have legal residency who have not yet become U.S. citizens. You can live a full life in the United States and not be a U.S. citizen, a perfectly legal residency kind of a life without being a U.S. citizen. My mother, as a matter of fact, was a legal U.S. Resident and never had become a U.S. citizen.
So let's name some other people who came in who were legal residents but not U.S. citizens. Started with Melania Trump, Mrs. Fred Trump, who was Trump's mother, came here from England. His grandparents came here from Germany. His first wife, whose name gratefully escapes me, they were all legal residents before they were citizens. And obviously, the purpose, well, let me turn this over to you. Why do you think that Donald Trump has been so intent on putting this citizenship question on the census? You want to take a wild guess, John Carlos Fry?
Well, you know, it's a form of voter suppression. It's a form of marginalization. It's a form of making sure that states like California and possibly Florida and maybe even New York State, which tend to lead, at least in the states of New York and California, tend to lead blue, aren't going to get the goodies that the federal government doles out. And in some form, can be a form of punishment, too. It's a way to keep last gasp of white American control over the way that the country is headed, which is much more of a melting pot, and demographics are very obviously changing quickly. You know, white majority is going to end in this country soon. So I see it as sort of last gasp attempt at keeping the brown and the black person down.
And keeping them from voting. I mean, that's the big thing. And, you know, you mentioned California and New York. Now, those are clearly blue states. But if you're going to talk about swing voting and where the black and the brown vote really will make a difference and could flip, you know, the Senate, the U.S. Senate and the Congress, you're really talking about Texas and Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
Florida for sure.
You know, huge. And Texas this year is really going to be in play for the first time in a long time. And Lyndon Johnson carried Texas in 1964. That may be the last time that
Arizona seems to be leaning that way, too.
Yes. Well, Arizona just elected a Democratic senator. So,
you know, you can kind of take, I think you can take California as a sort of petri dish example of this. I mean, when we had Proposition 187 pushed by our governor at the time, Pete Wilson, it was a big punitive slap in the face to anybody who was of Mexican-American descent. And people organized. People started registering to vote. People started becoming U.S. citizens. They empowered themselves. And our state legislature today is very diverse. There isn't a way today in California, at least, that you would be able to put an anti-immigrant measure on the ballot. You'd be laughed out of the state legislature. I think that's sort of what's starting to happen on a national scale. We have too many of the, quote, other now in the United States, and it's very hard to keep your thumb on them for very much longer.
Yes, and that's really what Trump is all about, and that's what this immigration... I don't think Trump could care less about anything, you know, starting with immigration personally. I mean, he couldn't care. Two of his three wives have been immigrants, for God's sakes. His grandparents were immigrants. His mother was an immigrant. I mean, you know, of course, his father was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So that kind of defines the situation here. But, you know, this guy doesn't care about anything except winning. And this issue is his issue because it's a shifting demographic. And the, as you put it 100% right, you know, this is the time when the majority, well, it's been long expected. Demographers have long predicted with accuracy that by 2050, whites will be in a minority in the United States. They'll still be the largest ethnic group, you know, white people of European descent. But by 2050, they'll be in a minority, as they are now in Hawaii and in California, and I believe New Mexico may be next. I'm not sure. But the wave is clearly coming across. And it's out. So this whole immigration thing is all about the shifting demographic and, you know, the endangered white male Christian. Although
God
I hesitate
forbid
to call a lot of these people Christian. So,
right.
So now I'm about to write a piece. Oh, by the way, before I lose track, tell us about your amazing book and also the event you've got tomorrow night in Los Angeles. I know we have some listeners in Los Angeles. And what happens in this show is we tend to start talking issue and policy, in other words, substance. And I miss the plugs I want to give. So your book is fantastic. Tell us about your new book and tell us about the event you've got tomorrow night.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. And the book is called Sand and Blood. It published this past Tuesday, just a few days ago. And it's a hard
look. Well, I don't know, John Carlos, I don't know much Spanish, but I just want to say mazel tov on that one.
thank you very much. It's a Spanish word my mother used to use all the time.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. It's a hard look from an investigative journalist's point of view at the U.S.-Mexico border and immigration. I've been reporting on the subject for almost two decades and have spent so much of my physical time on the border itself, in countries south of the border, Mexico, Central America, places that people come from, trying to really figure out this complex issue and how the United States handles it. And the premise that I have, or the argument that I make in the book, is that we're at war. We are at war at the U.S.-Mexico border, and our enemy, for the most part, are economic migrants, because that's the vast majority of people trying to get into the United States are people who are looking for a better form of life, whether they're fleeing violence or persecution, or they're trying to get a job to feed their families. These are the enemies that the United States has fortified the border in order to protect themselves from. They're not armed for the most part. They don't have, you know, they don't have the armaments of war, at least the people trying to get in, but we have met them with that kind of force and have spent most of our effort and most of our resources, financial resources, on trying to stop them from coming, as opposed to taking a look at reasons why they come and alleviate some of those. And even taking a look at some of the issues that we're involved in with these countries that may actually exacerbate and cause migration. So it's complex, but it's sort of a look at what the media doesn't cover. They seem to love to cover the criminal aspect of people coming across. Trump likes to call them invaders and terrorists and rapists, and it's hyperbolic, the conversation. This is a little bit more about policy, about history, and about maybe some solutions as well. And we have an event in Los Angeles on Friday evening. It's at a person's residence in Westwood. If you want any more information, you can basically just do a Google search for a Great Minds series. And that's run by an individual called Eileen Proctor. So Google any of those Great Mind series or Eileen Proctor, and you'll come up and you can RSVP to attend at 7:30 on Friday.
Right. That's Eileen is I-L-E-N-E and then P-R-O-C-T-O-R. Google her, find her website. John Carlos Fry is really not to be missed if you can get to this event and certainly get the book. Who's your publisher?
Publisher is Hachette in New York. You can also look me up on Facebook, John Carlos Fry, and you'll see the information for the event on Friday.
And that's F-R-E-Y, John
Correct.
Carlos Fry, F-R-E-Y. All right, so let's get back into this issue now, and then be sure to plug your book up before the end and the event, before the end of this. So you mentioned, in talking about your book here, the causes of this. So let's take it from the root here. Without me jumping in first, because I'll go crazy on U.S. imperialism, why are people coming here? Now, everybody knows what's going on at the border now. And
do you want to look at reasons that they're coming that we're responsible for, or do you want to? So, I mean, it's complex. People just think of why so many waves of immigrants came to the United States throughout our history. We have waves of Italians. We have the Germans. We have people from Asia. We have certainly the Jews during World War II tried to reach our shores. One of the reasons why we actually have asylum laws were people who were trying to get in who were victims of persecution. There are many, many reasons why people come. And the United States, for the most part, we have a kind of a checkered history on this, but for the most part, we are known as a welcoming nation. This administration...
Well, we were.
Well,
we were.
In at times, there were times that we were also restrictive. And we were also not so great with people who actually already lived here. You can take a look at how we treated Native Americans,
right?
How we treated Japanese, and you know,
The white Europeans are the initial immigrants, and they were really invaders, and they treated the people here as badly as people have ever been treated in the history of the world. And then you know, we had French coming into Canada in the north, Spaniards in the south, and then in the middle came the British, and the British were the worst. There's no doubt about that.
And then we also imported people in the form of slaves.
Yes.
So, you know, we have sort of a checkered history when it comes to the movement of people. And that's all really migration is people moving from point A to point B and maybe even sometimes back. This is an era that I have never seen before. And it feels more punitive, more restrictive, and the need to migrate, at least from our neighbors to the south, is very strong right now. Mexico is somewhat stable, but we're seeing an influx of people from Central America, and there are several reasons. One that the U.S. is somewhat responsible for is crime. El Salvador is on fire. The crime rates are through the roof. The murder rates are skyrocketing. Most of the country is run by gang members. The government is not strong enough in parts of the country, and they rule the roost, gang members. And we've probably heard the term MS-13. That is one of the dominant gangs in El Salvador that is a de facto government. El Salvador suffered a civil war about 25 years ago that the United States put its hands in. The Reagan administration had sent funds and troops and pretty much disrupted the stabilized government there. And so the country is fairly new in reforming. It doesn't have a strong law enforcement base. The government structure is fairly weak. And the United States prison population was dumped into El Salvador. This is a little bit of a complex story, but California enacted a law to underpopulate or to get rid of the overpopulation in state prisons. And most of those people who were sent to El Salvador were El Salvadoran immigrants who came as kids, who hit the streets in Los Angeles, became gang members, were legal residents, and California rescinded their legal residency status and sent them back as adults after they had already committed a crime. We sent 50,000 gang members from prisons in the United States back to El Salvador, and they reconstituted.
Wow.
They are now 50,000? 50,000. 50,000 criminals.
Just to El Salvador?
Just to El Salvador.
Oh, my God. I've never heard that. That's astounding.
It is astounding. We didn't send them with any sort of information. They didn't even have a dossier. We didn't know who was a rapist and who was a murderer and who was a petty thief. These individuals were dumped into the prison system in El Salvador, a system that was new and fairly unstable, and these gang members reconstituted. Many of them don't even speak Spanish because they came to the United States as children, and they speak primarily English. I have hung out with these people. I have talked to some of the leading gang members themselves, and we planted a seed, a pretty bad seed, in El Salvador, and fast forward 20-plus years, these gangs are now very powerful in the country, and they're causing quite a bit of havoc. They rule by extortion, they rule by violence, and people are fleeing because they're afraid for their lives. So the seed we planted 20-plus years ago, by the way, this is still a program that exists. We are still sending and deporting gang members. We think we're going to get rid of them all by dumping them into a foreign country, but lo and behold, here they are coming back to us, or at least the cause of their violence is coming to our borders. So that's just one example of how we meddle. We could take a look at capitalism and the way that we do business with Central America and with Mexico. We, our companies, U.S. companies, keep wages low. They don't abide by environmental laws. They don't abide by human rights laws because we have free trade agreements with these countries. So we can keep poor countries poor, and it's of great benefit to us. One of the largest employers in Central America is Walmart. And we know the unscrupulous practices, labor practices of Walmart. So people can't make a living, and so they come here, and the list goes on. So I'm sort of trying to kill two birds with one stone. People are coming because they can't find a job to make enough to make a living. They're coming because of violence. In recent history, in the last couple of years, we're seeing people come as a side effect of climate change. The El Nino phenomenon, which constitutes every 7 to 10 years in Central American waters, in the waters off of Central America, is out of whack. It's sort of the weather phenomenon that regulates rainfall, and we're seeing the El Nino pattern form every few years when we used to see it form every decade or so. And as a result, Central American farms are going without regular irrigation, with regular water, and they're experiencing a 5-year drought. And as a result, 2 million people, according to the United States, before famine status. I met people in the caravans that we heard about at the end of this past year coming up because they couldn't farm anymore, and they had lost their crops, and because they were hungry. I don't think that this administration even recognizes climate change as a reality, so they're not addressing that issue. That's another.
So we have.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So let's no, please. So we have El Salvador, we have Panama, we have Honduras, Nicaragua, and Belize in Central America. I'm missing Costa Rica.
And Guatemala. Guatemala.
And Guatemala. I'm sorry. Yes. And in every one of those countries, United States troops have intervened at least once, and not for the good. I mean, is it okay?
I wouldn't say for the good. They're all in. Costa Rica's not so bad. Panama has a large influx of outside influence of money. It's also a big tax haven, so there's some extreme wealth there as well that sort of trickles down a bit. The countries that are really in dire need today are Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Those are the ones that we see most migrants coming. 60% of all of the people that we're seeing at the border today trying to get into the United States are from those three countries. So they're the most in dire need.
And, of course, recently Obama and Clinton supported the overthrow of a democratically elected government in Honduras. Is that correct?
That is correct. It is a country run by horribly corrupt government officials. They steal from their own. The last time I was there, I was fortunate to be able to interview the president of Honduras, who had probably about 2,000 or 3,000 people standing outside his presidential palace, which where we did the interview, protesting the fact that he had, as the equivalent of our Social Security administrator, which is the office he held before the presidency, he had absconded with about $530 million that nobody knew where it went. And he was talking to me before we started the interview about redecorating his office. He has a replica of the Oval Office, twice the size, and he was undergoing a $20 million renovation of his office.
God.
While the people are outside protesting the fact that this guy's a crook. You know, I mean, that's the mindset.
And this is the guy that was supported by President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton.
I think I might get my history wrong. I think that he and Biden met face to face to sign an aid package from the United States to Honduras.
Jeez, I mean,
these places are really out of control. Honduras, for example, is the femicide capital of the world. That means that more women are murdered in the country of Honduras per capita than any other place on the planet. Women are victims of sexual assault. Women are victims of domestic violence. There's no place for them to go and issue a complaint. The police don't believe them. There are no shelters for women. They have to get out of the country if they want to protect themselves and sometimes their children. We're seeing the results of that at our border.
Oh, my God. And Nicaragua, well, Nicaragua, well, tell us about Nicaragua, because it's, you know, with the Sandinista saga, it's hard to know what's going on.
It's hard to know what's going on. Nicaragua, in addition to the other countries, we're not seeing as many Nicaraguans as from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. But Nicaragua is a place where drug cartels are starting to infiltrate as well. You know, we sort of tightened the screws in Colombia and went after the FARC and went after organized crime and the cocaine trade, and we didn't really get rid of it. We just kind of helped to dry it up a little bit, not that much, coming from Colombia. And it's reconstituted in Nicaragua and some of these other Central American countries, as well as Mexico. So, I mean, what the United States did was go after the drug lords, go after organized crime in Latin America, but did very little to go after the kids on college campuses that were doing drugs every weekend, you know. So the demand for it didn't stop. We're just trying to snuff out the suppliers.
Now, are we getting any refugees yet from Venezuela, or is it too far away?
I think it is too far away. I have heard of some, but that is quite a bit of a journey. Many of the Venezuelan refugees have gone to Colombia. There is an open door policy in Colombia for people from Venezuela. They are being welcomed. We're also seeing a lot of Venezuelans trying to reconstitute in Costa Rica and in Panama. That's a little bit more stable. Most of the people who are fleeing Venezuela are not the poor, because they don't have the means to flee. Most of the people who are fleeing are people who had some sort of capability of actually leaving.
Okay, so I'd love to talk with you about Venezuela, but I don't know if we get in there, we won't get to the rest of what's happening at our own border. So let's talk about now. My understanding and the bits of snippets that I've seen where there's been some reasonable coverage indicate that there's mass starvation in these three countries of El Salvador, in addition to massive violence, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the people are literally starving. Is that true?
That is true. World Food Program, which is a wing of the United Nations, has declared 2.1 million people as of February 2019 as food insecure. That number was 400,000 people the year before. So 1.5 million more people were added to the rolls. This drought is persisting. Climate models suggest that we're going to remain in this period of drought for a long time to come. And this is an area that farms corn and beans. Those are staple crops, and those crops feed families. They make the tortillas. They feed the livestock. And whatever extra that the farmers have, they sell out to market so that they get some cash in addition to that. This is a very stable climate. They could rely on the rains almost to the day on the calendar. And these farms have been fertile for over 1,000 years. We're talking about the region where the Mayans are from. You know, some of these farms are right in and around Mayan ruins. And so this is a cultural way of life that's existed for a long time, and these weather patterns have shifted. The rains come, they stop within a couple of weeks, the crops emerge, and then they dry up. And there's just really no other way to make a living. The economy relies almost 100% on agriculture. So the people I spoke to, I visited some corn farms in Guatemala and talked to the farmers there. They had lost their entire crops. They had already sold their farm animals, some of their farm equipment. They were looking to sell their land, and with whatever money they could get for that, they were going to go north. We're living, one of the farmers' families that I met, were living on one tortilla each a day for the family members. There were five people in this family. So five tortillas a day. I don't think that any of us would feel satisfied if we just had a tortilla for one day. So they were in pretty dire
need. You couldn't function. What could?
Yeah, they were thin, emaciated. They seemed weakened from what I can tell. Now, here's the strange thing about it. The World Food Program is instituting a program where they're basically going door to door, knocking on people and saying to them, we have cash. Here's some money. Go buy yourself some food. It's the most effective way to keep people in country. with the hopes that they have enough money to keep people in their homes, and hopefully the weather patterns will shift in the following season. Instead of selling everything, once you sell your farm equipment and your land, you've got nothing left. There's nothing left for you to fall back on. You've lost your way of life. The United States is not a participant in that program. We do not give money to the United Nations. The United Nations has raised the money because of climate change, and the people who donate that money are mostly from the European Union and Australia. The Trump administration isn't participating. So we're complaining about people coming up to the border looking for help because they're starving, yet we're not helping them stay in their own country. As a matter of fact, we're turning our backs on that program.
Right. Well, I mean, it's my contention that Trump wants them to come up. This is his issue. This is his way of intimidating, you know, rousing his base and intimidating the Hispanic people, population, and preventing them from coming out to vote. He's got a setback here on the census, but this is my feeling is that he's killing these kids at the border as a warning against Hispanic people voting. That's another way of looking at it. How much would it cost, John Carlos Fry, to feed the people in these three countries and have them want to stay and hopefully wait it out till the rains come? What would it cost the world and the country in terms of dollars given to people so that they won't go on the road and be murdered up at the border?
I don't know. We're not talking about a very large population. I believe that the entire country of Honduras is about 10 million people. With food aid from the entire world, I think it would be a small percentage. I think it needs to be compared to the multi-billion-dollar industry that we've built at the U.S.-Mexico border to keep them from coming. I'm assuming that it would be a very small percentage compared to what we spend to keep them from coming. The entire world, the entire budget from the United States to the country of Guatemala for food aid, when President Trump took office, was $23 million.
God.
So as far as our budget's concerned, it doesn't seem like a lot. He's actually reduced that amount. We're not talking about multi-billion dollars. I know that we have a program with Syrian refugees, which number in the several million, and we spend a few billion dollars a year to stabilize the Syrian refugee problem. And if you take a look at the documents that support our funding that program to help stabilize the refugees, to help build camps, to provide them with medicine and with food, it's basically so that they don't have to leave their country. We are supporting the fact that Syrians have had to leave from a war zone that we're not necessarily involved in, but we're not willing to do so with our neighbors to the south. We've funded that program with several billions of dollars to help stabilize the refugee crisis there.
Absolutely sickening. I mean, you know, it's infuriating to hear this. I mean, but, you know,
well, El Salvador isn't a whole country, according to Trump, right? So why would you dump money in, you know, I don't know if on your I'm supposed to use that word. But,
no, you're not, but that's okay. I'm not on this one. But, well, this one's
you understand what I mean.
Rebroadcast. There are stations we rebroadcast to that. But, you know, the president used that term. I never call him the president. Trump used that term, so I don't know why we can't.
One of the countries was El Salvador.
Yes, of course. And you know.
It's very clear.
Let's put it.
Harvey, it's clear as day. He does not want people to get into the United States from those countries. He is not willing to allow them to make claims of asylum. He's not willing to help them in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, I've been covering this issue for a long time, and to seal us off from them, whoever them is, doesn't really work. Desperate people take desperate action. And a border fence or a border guard may be a deterrent, but they're going to find their way around. And what happens today is that we have organized crime now helping these people to get across. So,
right.
You know, you put all the might of the United States military at the border, which we have, and a poor Mexican or a poor Central American farmer can still get across.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't agree that he doesn't care whether they get in or not. Trump has no concern about whether these people get in the country or not. What he wants is a crisis. This is a crisis for its own sake. This is a racist.
For what purpose?
You
why would you want to create that kind of chaos?
Because that's all he could do. And it also intimidates the Hispanic population from voting, and it fires up his base with hatred. You know, this is Hitler in the Sudetenland. I mean, this is all Trump cares about is crisis. And he couldn't care less about these people one way or another. And he is a mobster. And so if he's getting organized crime into this business of, you know, they're paying $750 a day to house a single 2-year-old migrant in a hellhole, basically. I mean, he's reproducing Bergen-Belsen here. These are concentration
camps. They don't even have a toothbrush or toothpaste
for $750 a day. Where does that money go?
Yes, exactly. It's absolutely sickening. So, and, you know, it's so infuriating I can barely talk about it. So what I want to, we're actually covering this issue extremely well. I mean, it's very clear to me that, let's put it in perspective, an aircraft carrier costs about $10 billion for an aircraft carrier. So why don't we not build one aircraft carrier? You think $10 billion would yeah. So, you know, it's absolutely, you know, sickening. What I want to talk to you now, John, John Carlos Fry, author of Sand and Blood with Hachette, publisher, has got an event tomorrow night in Los Angeles. Look up Eileen Proctor on Google and go to her website, find out where it is. What you did, John, you embedded yourself. You've got an incredible history, 5 Emmys and all these other amazing credentials as an investigative reporter. So you embedded yourself with a group, with a coyote, and you crossed the border. Can you take your time now and tell us about this? I mean, this is an incredible experience. And, you know, you're in the studio, you're in pretty good shape. I couldn't even begin to think about doing it now at 73, but you were able to withstand this situation. So tell us from start to finish about your journey across the border, please.
I had a production company in the United States who wanted to tell this migration story, and I've been trying to tell these kinds of stories throughout my entire career. They're not always that easy to get off the ground for the most part. But I had suggested to the television company, what if I cross the border illegally? What if I embed myself with a migrant group and I start in Mexico and we cross the actual physical line into the United States and cross wherever these individuals go and
go on their journey with
them? How is this done? What does it look like? What do they endure? We had started to see quite a large spike of migrants dying in the American Southwest deserts. And that was sort of the impetus of the story, to say who would in their right mind think it would be a good idea to trek through these treacherous deserts in August, which is when we did this, and risk their lives to such a degree. They must be something more going on than just a walk through the desert. They must be some sort of desperate people. And I thought the only way to do this was to just join them. Which was in itself kind of a ridiculous idea because I'm not a migrant and I don't necessarily look like one if there is a stereotypical look. So the idea of joining in with them and wanting to document the journey with a camera was probably pretty next to impossible. And I thought the only way I'm going to be able to do this is to do it the way they do. And today, if you're wanting to leave Central America or wanting to leave Mexico and get into the United States, you have to hire the help of Mexican drug cartels. They own the border. South of the United States, along that entire border, you can't cross until you pay a coyote. That's somebody who is your guide, and that guide is connected with organized crime. They are highly sophisticated human smugglers who get migrants from point A to point B for a fee. The fee at the time, this is now, I'd say 7 or 8 years ago, the fee at the time was $3,000 to go 70 miles, that is, from a point in Mexico to the U.S.-Mexico border and be taken across the border with a guide who knew the route. Now, this guide, it took me about 3 weeks in Mexico to be able to convince drug cartel, and I had to go face-to-face with them, try and convince them that all I wanted to do was to tell the story of the migrants and what they were enduring,
that I didn't want to infiltrate their criminal enterprise. And they agreed, to my surprise, but I also had to pay them. This was a business transaction for them. And I was not allowed to take my cameras and film their part of the enterprise. I was to keep my cameras away from anybody that I knew was a member of the cartel. I could only train my cameras on the migrants themselves on this journey. And they agreed. We had a handshake. I gave them $3,000 in cash. And they took me to a location where migrants gather south of the border. They introduced me to a guy that would then take us on this journey on foot. And we would make our way northward into Arizona, at an area that there's an Indian reservation called the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation, whose reservation is actually smack on the borderline itself. And this is a very known, well-known smuggling ring. And that's how we were going to cross. I joined a group of about five people. Everybody in the group was from Mexico. Everybody in the group had a job in the United States. They were all heading back to their jobs or going to their jobs for the very first time. And they were working for McDonald's. One was working for an asphalt paving company that paved parking lots for Walmart. These are all people who had connections in the United States via family members or friends who had places to go for work. So this pull factor that we have in the United States of hiring this large labor pool for Mexico was very apparent here. They all paid the coyote, paid the cartel the same amount that I did. And the first night on our journey, we were doing a stakeout. We were probably 50 yards from the borderline itself, and our guide was equipped with night vision binoculars. He had a cell phone. He had a satellite phone, and he had some sort of what appeared to me to be some sort of a walkie-talkie. He was in quick communication with someone, and it was my understanding as I learned more and more about how this was done, is that this guide south of the border had contacts north of the border, and he was in communication. He was in constant communication with lookouts on the U.S. side. Those lookouts in the United States kept relaying back to him information about Border Patrol activity. There are roads along the border that Border Patrol vehicles patrol. They go back and forth, and this guide would take a large branch. He would sweep the road that the Border Patrol vehicle went on, so he would know exactly what time that car would pass because he could see fresh tracks. And so they sort of got a schedule of the Border Patrol vehicle's patrol, and we went at a time when we knew that we wouldn't be around. We crossed the border on foot over not much of a fence. It looked like a cattle fence. It was very easy to scale. And we walked undetected. Nobody came to arrest us. And we walked at night. We walked during the day. We rested for short periods of time. He knew exactly. We would stop at times. He would get on his communication devices, and he would talk to whoever was on the other line. And it all appeared to me to be people at strategic locations in the United States directing him to go right, to go left, to stay put for an hour or whatever it may be, so that they could be guided to avoid detection. I never saw a Border Patrol agent. I never saw a helicopter. I never even saw anything off in the distance. We walked for 3 days in over 100 degree heat. I had to stop personally. The group went on without me. I had to stop because I ran out of water. And I started.
Wait, they didn't give you water? You had to carry your own water?
Yeah, I had to do everything that they did. There's no store close by. There's no house, no faucet. You're walking in open terrain where you don't see civilization at all, and that's on purpose. You know, the federal government has built fences, barriers, either in the form of a physical barrier or border guards, in and around our major cities that are near the border: San Diego, El Paso, Nogales, and Brownsville, a couple of other places along the border, so that migrants can't gain access to the cities and hide out there. They have not built border walls in areas that are open terrain, deserts, because migrants have no place to go. They're going to have to walk 3 or 4 days in order to get to even a road. So the thinking in the United States is if we leave the deserts open and we leave the mountains open, the journey will be so difficult that nobody will ever attempt it. Because you're going to have to walk 4 or 5 days in the desert to get to this road. Well, that's exactly what we did. And that's exactly the route that's left open. And this is why people die. That's the journey that I wanted to take. And after about 3 days, you know, a gallon of water weighs 8 pounds. So a couple of gallons of water is all I could carry, along with my equipment, along with a backpack with food and, you know, a change of socks and the things that you may need to kind of make a 3-day trek. And I had a satellite phone for emergency sake, and I had to use it. You know, I had to call my production team, which kept monitoring my whereabouts with the GPS marker that I had on me. And they came and rescued me, and my group went on. To this day, I don't even know if they made it. I was never able to contact them. But, you know, this is not a walk in the park.
How many people were in your party?
Five of us.
In your group? Five. All men or men and women? How did that
all men. All men, yeah. You know, it's I studied this issue at length, and there are different guides, different coyotes for different groups of people. If I paid $3,000 to get across, that's the rate that's for an able-bodied man to get across the border. If you're a woman with a child, that rate is $5,000 because it takes a little bit more finesse and expertise to make sure that the child or the woman doesn't suffer. There are guides who specialize in getting those people across, and they know the routes that maybe aren't as difficult. This is real trade. When we were in the holding facility before we crossed into the United States, we stayed at a horse ranch and held out until they staked out the border and told us what time we were ready to leave. That ranch had surveillance equipment that was monitoring the United States. They had a satellite array on top of their house. They had a helicopter pad so that they could actually lift a helicopter. This is all on the Mexico side, and they could survey the landscape from a helicopter perspective and see where Border Patrol assets were. It was my understanding that they also had some sort of technology that would be able to detect motion on the U.S. side. It is a multi-billion-dollar industry to get migrants from Latin America into the United States. It is highly organized and very sophisticated because it's big money. I spent $3,000 that night. I was told that there were 500 of us in the same general area that were going to make the journey that night. So what is 3,000 times 500 on one night?
Jesus.
Cash? Yeah.
Wow.
What is that?
This is mind-boggling.
$1.5 million a day they're making here. You know,
I hope you're going to make
$1 billion a year in just one location.
I hope you are, Giancarlo Esparza, you're going to make a film about this. I mean, this is staggering, absolutely staggering. And you had to jump ship. I mean, and you had the capability of jumping ship. And what happened to the other four guys?
Well, they went on their way. I mean, we had already reached about three-quarters of the way. We had walked about three-quarters of our journey, and so they didn't have that much further to go. And they're desperate.
But where were they going? Where were they actually going?
One was going to Atlanta. We were all headed to a road. They were going to hop into a car when we finally got to a road. I mean, we were really in the middle of nowhere at these vast desert lands just to get to a road to be able to hop into a car. So,
but the car was prearranged. The cars were prearranged?
Oh, yeah. No. This is very well organized. One kid was going to Atlanta. Another one was going to Washington State. The other guy was going to New York City. So they already had, with their fee, they had all of these rides arranged for them, as well as crossing the border.
Unbelievable. This is just unbelievable. I mean, I hope to God you put this on TV and we can see it.
We highlight quite in detail in the book. So,
well, you would do well to, I mean, this would be an amazing piece for, but I don't have to tell you. Giancarlo Esparza, your book is A Sand and Blood. It's with Hachette Publishers. You got an event tomorrow. What is the date? The 29th of June and
28th
Friday.
Tomorrow. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, 28th tomorrow. It's also my 30th. Hey, listen, unbelievable, John. We'll have you back. You're an amazing person,
okay.
Amazing guest.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Eileen Fry. Thank you. Studio in New York. We'll see you next week. and the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Don't you know we're gonna